You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
We were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older, and it's happening again.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, opening today's show with the music of Griffin House, I Remember, It's Happening Again. Regular listeners to Raising Sand Radio know that we've been airing a series of shows on war and its aftermath, and presenting voices of mothers and spouses, troops and veterans, the voices of those whose lands have become combat zones, as well as the voices of health providers and caregivers. Today it is my very great pleasure to welcome the voice of Stephen Tice, a father, husband, war veteran, and a certified trauma specialist with 19 years' experience as a program director and therapist in Veterans Administration programs, specifically addressing the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder in war veterans. For over four decades, Stephen Tice has dealt with war and its aftermath, and from many perspectives. He was severely wounded in one of the most well-known battles during the Vietnam War, that which has become known as Hamburger Hill. Today, Stephen Tice will talk to us about his war experiences and his coming home, his adjustment to his wounds, and his 12 years as a therapist and team leader of the outpatient community-based National Vet Centers, and 7 years as assistant director, as well as director of the inpatient post-traumatic stress disorder program at American Lake VA Hospital in Tacoma, Washington. I have Stephen Tice on the phone, and welcome to Raising Sand Radio, Stephen Tice.
Thank you, Susan. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, it's really great to have you, especially under the circumstances that we're facing today with so many veterans coming back from this war on terror. And your story, as I say, spans three decades and many different perspectives. So I'm going to open this up, and I'm going to ask you to start at the very beginning with how old were you when you were drafted to the war in Vietnam?
I was just a month shy, actually less than that, a few weeks shy of my 20th birthday when I actually was inducted. I was drafted when I was 19.
And what state were you in at this point?
A state of terror. I was living in California, and I was moving around. I was trying to lengthen the time between when I was drafted and whether I was going to go in or not. I knew I'd go in, but I was hopeful. It was the presidential election time. Bobby Kennedy was a peace candidate. I was hopeful that if I stalled a bit and moved around a little bit and didn't quite make it to the induction, that he would get elected and I would go into the service and that he would end the war. This was my dream, mm-hmm. and I would not end up in Vietnam. I had an older brother, and his name was Leon, and he had fought in Vietnam. He had volunteered in the early part, 65. And when he came back, he was disillusioned with the war and was urging me at all costs to keep my grades up in college, don't get drafted, don't go in. And this is from a man who wanted to make the military a career, as my father had wanted to, and had wanted to actually go to war. And then, you know, President Kennedy's do what for your country, what you can, and so on. And so I was being advised to not go by someone who I really trusted, and I didn't want to go.
And when he came back, did you notice that he had changed at all? Who did he, seem to be still a brother that you knew?
He was much more serious, and for the first time I was seeing some cynicism in him, which I had never seen before. He was the kind of guy that was lighthearted, and although he'd had some struggles as a youth, but he was definitely struggling with the war, and he was clear that he did not want me to go to this war. He was being a big brother. He was trying to protect me and want me there.
But there you were. You had your hair shaved and sent off to Vietnam.
Right. When it came down to the final decision, actually I made the decision the night Bobby Kennedy was murdered. And I was watching television, and I watched that. And the next morning, I called a friend and said, take me up to San Francisco, because that was my latest address, which was quite an event, because that was a lot of the protests were to go be inducted, we had to walk through the population that I actually identify more with than the soldiers, the anti-war population. And but this is 1968, and this is June of 1968, so things have changed in America from when my brother volunteered. There was a lot of ambivalence about the war at this point. So I felt like if I didn't go, I'd be dishonoring my family, and my family had always fought in wars and had done their part for their country, and I did not want to give up my citizenship or go to jail or any of those things. Those were just not options of who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really went in, and I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back, I went in to be a free man in America.
And so you were there for just a short while before you were engaged in this Hamburger Hill battle.
Well, actually, yeah, I was in Vietnam 6 months. I was with the 101st Airborne Division, and I was a field radio operator. I carried a large radio and was part of communications out in the field for a lieutenant and a platoon leader in combat with the infantry. The day I was wounded was what we call Hump Day. That was the first day of my 7th month, and what the day we thought, from then on, you're downhill in your time there. And, we went on something called Operation Apache Snow, which the soldiers later named Hamburger Hill. But it's interesting, I didn't hear the term Hamburger Hill until I was in the hospital and people were telling me that I'd been on Hamburger Hill. I didn't even know. That name had not drifted over to my company or my platoon.
And it was actually a hill. Why were we trying to take it?
It was in a place called the Asha Valley, and there was a ridge line, and the hill itself, underneath in bunkers and underneath the ground, they had hospitals and so on. It was a regimental headquarters for an NVA troop. It was near the Laotian border and the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and my understanding is that they were trying to interrupt all of that activity. Why the Army made the decisions they made in Vietnam beyond me, but it was the dilemma of taking territory and then giving it back, and for us, we were to take this hill.
And the battle went on for several days, didn't it?
It went on 10 days.
When were you wounded?
I was wounded on day 8.
Wow.
And, I was the day before I was wounded, I had been part of 5 guys who had survived an ambush, and a number of our friends had been killed, and we had been cut off from the whole company. It was an incredible day trying to survive, cut off from the company, pinned down by NVA machine guns. And so we managed to get out of it. The 5 of us, and carry our friends' bodies back up to the perimeter. And I remember thinking that night that somehow I had survived that. I was going to survive my time there. But the next day, May 18th, 1969, I was hit with a rocket-propelled grenade.
And it actually connected with you directly, didn't it?
Yeah, it was a direct hit. I was actually behind a tree. Laying on my belly. It looked like, from what the guys told me, that I was in firing position. It's possible that I was actually firing at the person that was firing at me.
Hmm.
I was a radio operator, so most of my duties had to do with communication. But when in combat, unfortunately, even if you try to choose a job that's not with you as shooting other individuals, situations arise. And I think a lot of medics understand this,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people that have jobs that are not supposed to be, by definition, combatant to become combatants.
Yeah, I've heard that a radio operator is one of the most dangerous career moves in Vietnam, simply because you had so many things pointing out of your sort of physical space that it was easy to pick out who the radio operators were.
Oh, yeah. We have, they have different sizes of antennas, and at times they had to use the real the long antenna, and that certainly would get you away. But, the enemy is trained to take out leadership, communications, and firepower. And I was the communication, and you can bet right near the communication is going to be the leadership. And
mm-hmm.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
Lieutenant was always right by me, and right by him. And I'm sure they were knew what they were aiming at. Mm-hmm.
Was he hurt, your lieutenant?
The lieutenant, when I was wounded, he was right to my left. We were behind a large tree, and the tree, they were huge trees. And you talk about old growth, so these were old trees, and they were pretty protective. And he was next to me on it. I understand that he got a jolt and got bounced around, but he was not wounded. The RPG took off my hand and hit me in the face and the chest and down to my right side, all on my right side, which shows that I was on my belly looking out to my right side around the tree. The lieutenant later in the day was killed by a sniper.
Oh.
Yeah.
So the medics came out and you were evacuated.
Well, actually, the medics came out. And this is the thing about soldiers that is just so powerful. Several soldiers and a couple of my friends, there's action going on. There's a firefight going on. But a couple of people pulled themselves back and took care of me. And the medic did a really good job taking care of me. But not only physically, but psychologically, and talking to me about my family and trying to keep me alert and not closing my eyes, because that was usually the sign that the person was going to die. We tried to keep people alive, and it was a powerful moment. They were telling me, you get to go home, you're going to be okay, and those things, although I must have been a sight, and I'm sure that they were probably very frightened of what was going to happen to me. Mm-hmm. But to get out of there, we were in the woods. They couldn't land a chopper. They had a drop jungle penetrator basket down into the forest and put me in it and pull me out. So they had to sit up above there getting shot at in the medevac helicopter and pull me out.
And there you were, again, a huge target, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Could you look around? Were you conscious enough to...
My eyesight was going, and it was almost like looking through like a fisheye. Voices were getting deeper and sounding like a record slowing down as I laid there. The wound to my head, and my eyesight was going, and I could see a little bit all the way to the point that I got to the medevac hospital, and after that I couldn't see anymore for about 3 or 4 days.
With this war going on now in Iraq and Afghanistan, does it bring up memories for you? What is the effect of, this war?
Oh, certainly. And I think that's true for veterans of most wars. The veterans that I've talked to have been deeply stirred by the current war and feel much compassion towards the soldiers that are fighting now and what they're going through. But it also brings up, one's own pain and troubles, and especially when I'm talking to veterans who are amputees, as I am, and who have been wounded in combat. I have much compassion and for them and for myself. It takes me back to that time.
So you have a lot to share with the veterans. And I think of you in this, I don't know how you feel about this little label, but I think of you as a national treasure in a way to our vets, because you really have, you've been through the whole thing as well as the psychological surviving.
Oh, thank you, Susan. How my involvement in helping other veterans, my initial reaction to being wounded and hospitalized, and once I made it through that well over a year of hospitalization and many operations where they didn't think I would be coming back, and when I was coming through all of that, all I could think of was get away from the military, get away from all of this, go back to who I am, reclaim myself who I was before. And it was not realistic. It couldn't happen, but I wanted it. Mm-hmm. But during that time, I remember praying and saying that I would, if I survived, would do something meaningful with my life. I made that commitment.
And you have.
Yeah, and it's been driven. It's a spiritual drive.
But I know that your mother came to visit you when you were in Saigon in the hospital.
No, I was actually medevac from the field hospital to an evac hospital in Da Nang in Vietnam, and they got me out of there in about 3 days because they couldn't keep the wounds clean. So they medevaced me to Japan, and I was in Yokohama at an army hospital for 6 weeks, which was unusual because usually men died fairly quickly there, or they pulled through and were able to travel to the United States. So it was really a relay station. It was unusual because during the time I was there, I went into a coma. I had a central nervous system seizure, cardiac arrest. And although that was brief, it took so much out of my body that they couldn't evac me, and so I ended up there trying to recover for quite some time.
And both of your parents came, didn't they?
Yes, yes. My mother came over directly as soon as she found out. There was a delay in letting them know I was wounded. So it was 5 days after I was wounded before they knew. Once they knew, the Red Cross contacted my mother, and my parents had been divorced many years before. My mother came directly over. My father was a couple of days behind her.
And your father had also been in the war, hadn't he?
My father actually is a survivor of the Bataan Death March and of World War II, and a survivor of being imprisoned at Cabanatuan prison camp in the Philippines for nearly 3 years. There's a recent film called The Great Raid and a book called Ghost Soldiers that depict his story. In fact, he's in that book.
So he knew how to talk with you.
Oh, yeah.
He must have been brokenhearted when you were drafted.
I don't know that he was. At the time I was drafted, he actually helped my brother get into the service. And understand my family had served in every war and were very patriotic. I was a bit of a loose cannon there for a while. I believe he thought that the military would help me grow up a little, and I don't think he envisioned that I would be in the position I was in, you know, but and nor would he have wanted that. But I think that in some ways, thought that I'd probably help me grow up a little.
Yeah, I hear that from parents now, actually, in this war. They say that their sons or their children have learned discipline by being in this. So your parents stayed there with you, and did they come back with you as you returned to, did you go to Walter Reed, or where?
Actually, what they try to do in the military is put you close to home, unless you had a specialty kind of wound. Mm-hmm. And Walter Reed would, for people coming back on the East Coast or with a specialty wound, if I had been burned, I might go to San Antonio. And what they did is they put me into Letterman Hospital in San Francisco, which was close by to my family in California, and so that they could visit. My mother was over there most of the full 6 weeks. My father was there a couple of weeks. He had to get back to work. He was only given 2 weeks to come over, and he had to use his own personal vacation time to come over. His boss was not as thoughtful about the process as my mom's was.
Mm-hmm.
And he is pretty much on him. He paid his own way. He took a loan out. And while the Red Cross paid my mother's way, and her place of employment not only gave her a leave of absence, but they sent me gifts and cards, and they were really remarkable.
So here you are now. You're back in San Francisco, and I know that you got married, and you had a couple of sons, and then you began to have some of these feelings of anger, but not really recognizing what they were related to.
I married a friend and who had been a woman who had been my friend, Lisa, and beforehand, and she was so good to me and so helpful to me as I was recovering. We were married and we had one son at that time, and in the first few years we sort of hit out and were young during the time, but I had to go back in the hospital. I was struggling with nightmares and other symptoms of PTSD. In fact, there was nothing called PTSD at that time. I was really struggling with anger. It was misplaced. The anger would come out passive-aggressively, sarcastic towards my wife and some friends and so on. And so people started drifting out of my life, and eventually my marriage broke up. And it was largely out of my cynicism and anger and frustration about what had happened to me. I was lost.
But you didn't really know where this had come from, or you were beginning to get a sense that this was related to the experiences that you'd had in the war?
Yeah, I was getting pretty clear that the war was a problem, but I was not willing to talk about it or address it or anything. I really felt that because I had survived all the kinds of combat I'd seen and the wounds I'd seen, that I was tough enough to get myself through this, but I wasn't.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually a common thing that you hear from troops. Some of them are quite shut down in terms of, you know, what they've experienced and how to think about it in a way that is healing for them, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, we all develop coping styles. You know, any of us that are in a stressful situation are develop coping styles. And one thing to do in a war is to dissociate from what's going on around you because it's so chaotic and horrific, and try to keep things together. For me, I was very task-directed. I was on the radio where I was just doing my job while all of this chaos was going on around me. I would tune it out the best I could and do my job. And when I came home, I was tuning people out of my life. I was doing great in graduate school and so on. I could do those things, but I couldn't manage interpersonal relationships very well.
When you went to graduate school, were you studying something around the healing therapies, or were you doing something totally different?
I was in my head. I was doing an intellectual program. People were saying, well, you could become a social worker, and the counselors were and all that. And I was, no, I don't want to do that. I was doing research and doing a lot of writing, and I was up in my head.
And then what happened? I mean, how did you get into the healing area?
That came about because in the about 1907, I was told by a doctor that I was seeing at the VA that there was a counselor there that saw Vietnam veterans with difficulties. He said he wanted me to see them, and I did not want to do it. And he pushed on me, and so I did see this person, and essentially, the person did a lot of grief work with me and what they were calling post-Vietnam syndrome in the 1970s.
Hmm.
And he helped me sort through what was going on with me, helped me grieve my losses, and helped me see how my behavior was coming out, how it was looking to other people. And I put my family back together, and, we all did. We worked to put our lives back together, Lisa and I. And had another child, and then I heard about a program that was called Vietnam Veteran Outreach Program at the time, and it's now called Readjustment Counseling Service for Veterans. With the veterans themselves manning the, or people who were very sympathetic to veterans' issues, and dealing with this new diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. This is 1979, 1980. And I applied for the job. I wanted to give something back. I felt that I had been given a new life, that I had. I was now seeing my life as bonus time rather than seeing myself as a victim. I was seeing myself as having this life ahead of me, and I wanted to give back. So I applied, and they did a lot of training and so on. And they liked the idea that they were getting people with graduate degrees who had been through their own therapy and were combat veterans, did a lot of training, went to work helping veterans dealing with their PTSD.
Now, I know you can't really put a time frame on anybody else's healing, but from the time that you were first wounded until this period that you're describing now, how long would you say that was? Was several years?
It was, I would say, about 8 years for me. But in the first couple of years, I was hospitalized, and I was dealing with surviving. And then I think the next few years after that, I was just glad to have survived and was overcoming disabilities just to be able to tie my shoes and, you know, do things on my own. I was learning how to be a one-armed person. But all during that time, I was having nightmares and intrusive thoughts and so on of combat. I mean, I'd walk in a bank and I'd picture, you know, somebody coming in and robbing and shooting people, me trying to do something about it. I mean, it was just like every place I went, I saw danger. And what I hear from the young soldiers now is when they're in vehicles, because the vehicle in Iraq is the one that's is being blown up all the time is under driving, they're seeing themselves back in that situation in danger. And I would say I was exhibiting those same kinds of reactions the first years that I was home.
Can you talk a little more about intrusive thoughts? How is that different to me, for example, going into a bank and briefly thinking, well, you know, this could be held up, but then I let it go? How is that different?
Because the person that has been through the trauma knows it can happen.
Uh-huh.
And that it can happen to him or her. To live on this planet, let's face it, we have to have a pretty decent denial system, you know, that something terrible is not going to happen to us. Most human beings think, well, bad things happen to other people. They don't happen to me, especially young people. I carried those qualities right into Vietnam with me. I never believed I would get wounded. I was surprised when I was wounded. I thought that happened to other people, and I called them medevacs. I didn't know it happened to me. So the difference between me and a person that has not been through huge trauma is that I know it can happen.
And you know what all of the aftermath of that is, too, the pain, the anguish, the anger.
Sure, yeah. Sure. So, you know, basically the difference is that the person who has been traumatized, they know it can happen. And another person might think, this could happen, but probably happened to somebody else.
We did the Winter Soldier hearings, I think that was way back in April, May, talking about driving. A lot of them have accidents, and some of those accidents are considered to be just accidents, and some of them are actually considered to be suicide or suicide attempts. I actually didn't put together that driving would be the area that would be so traumatizing for them because they're on the road so much and the IEDs are killing so many of their friends.
Yeah, I think that the automobile in automobile drives would be for like a Vietnam veteran would be like a helicopter ride or eliciting the same kinds of fears because that's the symbolic vehicle of the wars.
You know what I'm thinking of right now is I did an interview with a nurse from Vietnam, Lily Adams, and
oh, I know those.
Do you? Yeah, we were sitting having lunch in San Francisco, and a helicopter flew over, and she automatically looked up, and I'd seen this before, and I asked her about it, and she said, "Yeah, that's actually something that I recognize from Vietnam because when we heard that sound, we knew we were going to be working on the wounded for the next, you know, whatever day or so."
And sure, and they'd look up to see how many choppers were coming in.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So it would be her natural reaction.
And these things don't go away. I mean, I had lunch with Lily in 2004, and she was in Vietnam, so also decades later, that sound still affects her.
Well, you know, it's the imprinting, and when you're in somewhere that, in the situation of life and death, the events and the things that happen around you imprint, and they're there, and you will react to them for your lifetime. The difference between like post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic stress disorder is that with post-traumatic stress, that's expectable to have stress following trauma, and the disorder part is when you aren't able to integrate it into your life and to manage your symptoms and to get on with life in a way that's meaningful to you and feels safe to you, at least relatively, and so symptoms emerge and people struggle. So all of us, even at this point in my life, if I have a reaction to certain kinds of situations, it doesn't surprise me that other people do. It's when that becomes difficult and people don't sleep and they struggle and they're angry and they're frustrated with things and they can't seem to get their lives on track.
Well, I'm wondering how much that has to do with people coming back to such an ordinary situation. You know, you return from Vietnam and things, there's a protest going on, but life isn't the kind of life and death situation that you're facing over there, which I think is something that the current vets come back and again, you know, life has just continued. In fact, we've had our president tell us, you know, don't worry about this, go shopping. Do you think that has something to do with how difficult it is to adjust?
Well, Americans have been relatively, you know, we have been attacked in New York City in 2001, but other than that and a few other instances, Americans, for the most part, have had a fairly safe life. There are neighborhoods and cultures in our country and places in our country that aren't safe, but for the most part, Americans have been, they haven't been part of war. They haven't seen it like other populations in other countries have. Mm-hmm. And they've been pretty insulated from it. And so when soldiers come back, it's good that they welcome them back now as opposed to Vietnam. And those things are good, but really understanding what the soldiers went through, nobody but the soldiers really understand. And it's that isolation from the general public, and that's the journey home really is to become a part of the community again. And it's difficult, particularly in the beginning. Soldiers feel so alienated. You know, people's problems and so on are real different than getting shot at.
And then I suppose to some extent also there's a sense that the anti-war movement here understands something about the process that they're going through. But at the same time, as you say, they haven't actually been through it. And so the soldiers, again, could begin to feel alienated even from that.
Oh, yeah. I think an anti-war movement or whatever, you know, there are people who are involved in that movement to stop a war, I think, for very good reasons, and they care about their country and their soldiers being safe and so on. And there's other people that are in it for other reasons and may not have the compassion for the soldier or for the situation that they were in that they could have. And for the soldiers, they may come off as arrogant.
And speaking for them.
And that's not how the soldier feels.
Yeah.
And I think, too, that for most soldiers, and you can see this even in the film Private Ryan, a World War II film, or talking to World War II vets and Korean War vets and Vietnam War vets and all up the line from Grenada to Panama to the First Gulf War, et cetera, all the way through the different wars that we've been in, that soldiers may go to war to stop communism or to stop the spread of terrorism. They may go there for that. But most soldiers in combat end up fighting to get home and end up fighting to get their friends home safe and whole.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes the goal. And all of the political stuff that goes on and all within America can be confusing to them and uncomfortable.
I did an interview with an Israeli woman who had lost a daughter in a suicide bombing on the street in Israel, and two of her sons were in very elite units, and they became refusers, actually very well-known refusers in Israel. And she said, a soldier's life is about who's on either side of him and who's got his back. As you say, you know, the rest of it doesn't really matter. You know, I'm taking care of my buddy is taking care of me, and she said the only thing that they ever think about is getting home.
And I see that now with the veterans from the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars, even now. The ones that are home, many of them have friends that are still over there or over there again because of the redeployment, and they are in contact with them by
emails
and they're very concerned about them, and their concern is deep and powerful that their friends get home. The confusing part of this war, I think, that is going to create a different kind of set of symptoms or of PTSD, or at least exacerbate them, is this whole issue of redeployment. The multiple tours is that when does the soldier actually stop and start looking at what's going on with them personally and all? When is it safe to let down the guard? When you're going back, it's just not safe.
Stephen, let me take a moment and remind our listeners that this is Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford, FM 90.1. We're talking to Stephen Tice about war and its aftermath. And I wanted to talk, Stephen, a little bit about the growing number of veterans seeking care after often multiple tours of duty and the different kinds of modalities that are available as treatments for them.
You know, when Vietnam vets came back, there were a few isolated folks doing work. And instructors I had been working with Holocaust survivors and found that group work well for, and as things went along, we found out that with soldiers, group work well is to bring together the survivors to the group that they most trusted and that they went through the experience with. You can't bring back the guy's platoon, but you can bring back other people who had like experiences. So group really became a mode in the early years, and I think still to this day is really preferable as a treatment modality. In the 80s, convincing mental health professionals that PTSD was actually a real diagnosis and wasn't a veteran, a gold bricking or something, a soldier's gold bricking or trying to get something, was difficult. And there's still a population of mental health professionals that are opposed to the diagnosis. However, things have changed very dramatically in the last 15, 20 years. There are so many modalities that have come out, people pushing different modalities such as EMDR, eye movement desensitization. It's a mode. It helps break through people who are resistant to treatment or resistant to getting to the emotions and so on. But there are a number of modalities. I think that what really works for veterans and with PTSD is to be where they are. First of all, to create an atmosphere of safety for them, where they feel both physically and emotionally safe with the therapist. So the connection with the therapist, to me, is critical. Otherwise, you're going nowhere. And from there, taking the veteran to reconstruct the trauma story, to take the veteran through the experience. Now, some veterans can tolerate that and some can't, so you have to make a decision of how to go about that. Do you do it symbolically or do you actually take them through the story so they can see themselves through other eyes other than their own as to what happened? Because most veterans in trauma situations will see themselves as not having done enough because their friends died or were wounded and they just didn't do enough. And so they're hard on themselves, and so they have to have them rethink and reconstruct the trauma to see what they in fact did do. And did they do things that were positive? And if they did things that were not positive in their mind, can they forgive and go through that kind of process? And that's the deepest and difficult part of the therapy. In the last stage of the therapy, I think, and among people I've read, and I love the work by Judith Herman, Trauma and Recovery, is reconnecting with the community and reintegrating with the community.
The community of?
Well, starting with perhaps the family, the community around oneself, and up to the nation and the world. I think if we begin to see ourselves as part of a whole again and not isolated from them, certainly we don't agree with everybody, but that we feel that there is at least there's a community that I am part of.
We're talking to Stephen Tice, who was wounded in Vietnam, about his recuperation and making a life despite severe wounds. Stephen, as a military mom or a family member or a military spouse, how might I recognize that my loved one is showing symptoms of PTSD?
Oh, I think, inordinate amount of drinking or escape type of behavior.
Meaning what's an escape behavior?
Escaping the responsibilities of life. And when soldiers first get back, I think we have to expect some of that, but mm-hmm. they want to drink with their buddies and talk and be with their friends.
Which is actually not unhealthy, is it?
Nah, it becomes a problem when alcohol stays as the primary instigator of the group being together. And I've heard a number of veterans talk about how when they first got back that they had little cadres, especially because of the guard folk. They all go back to the same community.
Mm, true.
And so then they would get together and have nights out and stuff, and they would drink a little, and then they would talk about their experiences with the alcohol. But as time went on, they dropped the alcohol part and had connections, or at least slowed that part down, understood that that was becoming a problem. And I've heard that from soldiers, especially from National Guard folks. If the social connection just becomes a way to drink or another place to drink or so on, alcohol numbing, the soldier's not sleeping, having trouble with anger and frustration, You know, all these things are going to be there, but if they become inordinately out of range of what one would expect, then a certain amount of dissatisfaction and or sadness or those things are to be expectable. They are expectable. When people are showing signs of clinical depression and so on, then you start worrying about perhaps this is good for them to get connected with a PTSD counselor and so on. But it's hard to tell. And I would say all this as well about there are certain populations in war that have more difficulty than others in accessing help. And right at the top of that, I would say, are officers and medical people.
Hmm.
Because they are the officers are the ones that take care of other people. They're the ones in charge. To say that I have a difficulty is more difficult. Medics are the caregivers.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard a number of medics also talk about the decisions they have to make when they're triaging.
Oh, yes. I've actually gone into groups that that some vet centers have had that have medics only in them, and as a guest and as a person who was blown up and hurt, and to talk to them about my experience with them and also to hear their experiences where they made triage decisions. And it's very deep and it's very powerful. They deal with some of the hardest questions and hardest situations medics do that anybody in war could ever imagine. Yeah.
Stephen, how are you these days? How is your health?
I actually was able to work for nearly 20 years, which is a blessing. At first, when the chronic pain having to do with my multiple wounds, I was hit all the way down my right side of my body, and I had internal damage, and I'm missing some organs and internal organs, and I'm missing my right arm and shoulder, and I have a lot of chronic pain problems. And initially, when it got to the point where the pain got to the point in the late 90s that where I thought I can't do this anymore, I can't work, and I felt betrayed by my body, that my body had succumbed. And through some therapy, I was able, in talking with family and Elisa and thinking it through, I came to the realization that, in fact, my body had been a powerful body. It had withstood a direct hit from an RPG, which is unheard of. And I had been able to go to college and graduate school and to work for 20 years. And I was able to be thankful to my body for getting me through that.
Mm.
And from there, I was able to start making changes in the way I lived that could help me live healthier. I do meditation, taking walks daily. I became a vegan, which surprised the hell out of me. I'm a major meat eater. But I started just looking for every angle of hood to try to live healthy. And even with all of that, I struggle physically, there's no doubt, and I have to take things easy. I've gone back to work one day a week working with PTSD clients with a local psychologist, James Sullivan, who had such a caseload that he needed help, and so I work one day a week. But I'm pretty tired after that day, and I rest for a couple of days. I do presentations. I teach classes sometimes. I do interviews. But I have to spread it out. It's all pacing, and I have to be very, very careful.
And how are your sons? You have three sons?
Three sons. I have my what I call my little PTSD boy, who unfortunately was born right after, unfortunately, because this is the most beautiful thing that happened to me, and it happened, it's interesting, he was born during the time, 3 years later that I would have been in Hamburger Hill.
Hmm.
Changing that whole period of time around for me that had been so traumatic to be blessed with a son in May of 1972. But I have to think of him in those terms because he was having to deal with a father that was struggling. He's my oldest, and I have a son that will be 30 this year and a son that's 24. They are a joy to me, as is Lisa, my wife, and I feel blessed. I feel like I'm on bonus time, that this is a blessing that's been given to me and that I have to use it to the best use that I can. The healing part and the part that, you know, sharing my story and the healing part, the final answer is finding value in sacrifice. And I think that's true for anybody that's a trauma survivor of any kind of trauma, is that we can find some value in our sacrifice and make it work for us, and not make the trauma better, but make our reaction to it healthier, and find value in that sacrifice. That's where the healing lies. It sure has for me. Mm.
Stephen, I want to thank you for being with us today, and I know this is going to be a program that is going to help other vets, and we're going to try and get it out to them as much as we can.
Oh, I'm just really pleased to have been on with you, Susan. I know that I'm talking to the American public in general, and I'm hoping that they're hearing what veterans go through, but I also love being reconnected with brother and sister veterans and soldiers.
That was Stephen Tice, a veteran wounded at the battle that became known as Hamburger Hill in Vietnam, talking about his own healing process and how that journey affected his family, and how subsequently he worked for years as a therapist with other war veterans. You can email me at susan@raisingsandradio.com if you want more information on how to get in touch with Stephen Tice. As we head into the presidential election, it is essential that Americans know more about the long-term effects of war. With both presidential candidates promoting a strategy for further troops deploying to the combat zones in Afghanistan, it is essential that citizens get a sober look at the human and financial costs of war. Raising Sand Radio has aired shows on this topic in the past, and I direct you to our website, www.raisingsandradio.org, to listen to these shows. They include interviews with mental health practitioners, to military moms, to the troops themselves, and to Afghan and Iraqi civilians, too. We're going to stay on this topic of war and its aftermath for a couple of weeks. Next week, we'll air an interview with Lisa Tice, Stephen Tice's wife, and we'll hear her perspective on being the wife and partner of a wounded veteran and the sorts of challenges she and Stephen faced and indeed are still facing. We'll also talk with Iraq war veteran Tyler Boudreau about his book, Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. Tyler Boudreau deployed to Iraq early in 2003 as a second lieutenant. By April 2005, his concerns about the war, combined with his deep affection for his Marines, made him unable to remain in uniform any longer. He relinquished his command and resigned his commission. And on that note, let's review where things stand with our veterans today. In a recent study, the RAND Corporation stated that some 300,000 U.S. troops are suffering from major depression or post-traumatic stress from serving in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and about 320,000 troops have brain injuries. You may hear this TBI, traumatic brain injury. It's a function of the explosions that the troops are facing so much. This RAND Corporation study goes on to state that only about half of these 620,000 troops have sought treatment. There are reasons for that, too, and if you listen to our other shows, you'll begin to understand more about that. These results appear consistent with a number of mental health reports from within the government, although the Defense Department has not released the number of people it has diagnosed or who are being treated for mental problems. The Department of Veterans Affairs said this month that its records show about 120,000 who served in the two war zones and are no longer in the military have been diagnosed with mental health problems. Of the 120,000, approximately half, that's 60,000, are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. This is from the Veterans Administration. Suicide statistics are extremely high. Dr. Ira Katz, the VA's head of mental health, wrote in an email on February 13, 2008, that, and I quote, "Our suicide prevention coordinators are identifying about 1,000 suicide attempts per month among veterans that we see in our medical facilities." It's also worth noting that Dr. Katz was interested in keeping the statistic out of the public eye, and I want you to notice that the 1,000 suicide attempts per month that they're tracking or have tracked are only those that they see in the VA medical facilities. Often the troops can't get an appointment in the VA because they're so overwhelmed. Then there are the presidential candidates and what they're doing or not doing for the troops. Despite his assertion that no one cares more about veterans than he does, Senator John McCain's performance with the GI Bill, known now as the 21st Century GI Bill, certainly sends a mixed message. In public, indeed in his very first presidential debate with Senator Obama, McCain gave the impression that he supported increasing the GI Bill. In fact, he did not. The very same GI Bill that gave him and many of his veteran peers a seat in college, he tried to cut back on for today's vets, many of whom have done multiple tours of duty. McCain believed that there should be a sliding scale of benefits based on time served, and that an increase in benefits would, and I quote, "be a disincentive for service members to become non-commissioned officers." He calls these non-commissioned officers the backbone of all the services. In other words, he's stating that giving veterans an education benefit is bad for the military. Keep in mind, again, as I said, that many of our young people are serving multiple tours of duty, and many of them also were recruited due to the promise of a college education. McCain claimed to support the 21st century GI Bill, but never endorsed the bill in the Senate. In fact, he introduced a competing GI Bill that would have left the average veteran with $20,000 in student loans. Eventually, the Senate passed the bill 75-22, and Senator McCain skipped out from voting on that bill. At the end of June 2008, President Bush signed the bill into law, ironically praising the three senators who opposed it, one of whom was Senator John McCain. Finally, let's not forget the other side of this war, the Iraq and the Afghan people. Many of us have heard of the study conducted by Johns Hopkins in Baltimore and reported in the prominent British medical journal The Lancet in 2004 that found at least 98,000 Iraqi civilian deaths up to October 2004. The second survey in the summer of 2006 interviewed a separate but also randomly chosen sample of 1,849 households and found in excess of 655,000 deaths leading up to June 2006, of which 601,027 were said to be from violence rather than natural causes. This amounts to 2.5% of Iraq's population, or more than 500 deaths a day since the invasion. The British polling firm Opinion Research Business, ORB, asked 1,720 Iraqi adults in 2007 if they had lost family members by violence since 2003. 16% of those asked had lost one, and 5% had lost two members of their family. Using the 2005 census total of error, ORB says, "We believe the range is a minimum of 733,158 to a maximum of 1,444,063 deaths." Frederick Burkle, a professor in the public health department at Harvard University, believes the number of civilian casualties may be higher than the Johns Hopkins figure. Burkle, who ran Iraq's Ministry of Health after the war until he was fired by the United States and replaced by a Bush loyalist, said the survey ignored the occupation's indirect or secondary casualty deaths caused by the destruction of health services, unemployment, and lack of electricity. And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford. Again, you're invited to email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org and suggest shows you'd like to hear in the future. And as always, all views expressed are those of the host and guests of Raising Sand Radio and not of Stanford University or KZSU Stanford. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And let's go out again with Griffin House. I remember it's happening again. You can also view this music video on our website.
And her dad always told us stories around dinner time. And there's one he told when I was young that sticks out in my mind. He
said 10 years after Daddy taught me about the birds and bees, I was stranded in Pearl Harbor fighting off the Japanese. When the kamikaze pilots came and dove in without warning, I was on the Arizona on a warm December morning. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older, and it's happening again. It was hard to have forgiveness for the things they did that day, and our president decided we should make their people pay. So we dropped on Nagasaki and we cut him down to size. And the one we dropped on Hiroshima left him vaporized. And I heard some Christians saying, what would Jesus do? What if you were on the wrong side? Would he point the gun at you? And they read through every word of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, so they could see if killing was the side that Christ was on. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older, and it's happening again. And they separate the church and state and keep God out of schools so our governments can educate based upon their rules. But people start to wonder if our politics make sense when religion is our best excuse for national defense. And when our citizens start saying that our wars are not okay, and Washington keeps telling them God loves the USA, and they teach us history so we can learn from our mistakes. And this generation wants to know how many years it takes to change the way we treat our neighbors all across the land. 'Cause if we don't change our hearts, we repeat the past again. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now we're older, and it's happening again. Grandpa finished talking, we went walking, he and I. I was thinking of the future and how scared I was to die. Now my best friend's overseas, in the desert where it's dry, fighting for our country, and I need a reason why. I remember when he was a younger man. Now he's a soldier fighting in a foreign land. Now we're older. God bring him home again.